You are listening to WPVM LP 103.7 in Asheville, North Carolina. And globally at WPVMFM.org.
Well, howdy, buckaroos and buckarettes.
Here's your Radio Asheville weather report. We enjoy a mix of clouds and sun today with highs peaking near 78. Fog and a stray shower or two are possible overnight while temperatures settle in the upper 50s. Saturday starts out dry, but showers become more likely through the afternoon and evening with a few rumbles of thunder and some wind. Highs reach the mid-70s before dropping to the mid-50s overnight. I'm Johnny Cottle on Radio Asheville 103.7.
Welcome to Twice 5 Miles Radio, fertile ground for conversations worth listening to and remembering. I'm your host, James Nave. Today I'm going solo. I'm recording this at Lake Eden Retreat in Swannanoa, North Carolina. Today is March 31st. Tomorrow is April 1st, April Fool's Day. And the reason I'm going solo today is because I would like to reflect on something that happened to me March 31st, 2011. And what happened on that day was a surgery. I had surgery for prostate cancer. And on April the 1st, April Fools, I woke up and dictated my first poem in a series of 100 poems, which I wrote in 100 days. I call them poems now. Actually, prose reports would be more accurate. My idea was to try to stay relevant while I recovered. The prostate surgery was radical surgery. I had a recovery period of about 3 weeks before I could get back on my feet and really move around, and a 3-month recovery period before I could get back really into the swing of everything. So I knew I would have to take it easy for 3 months. I also knew that for the first week, I would be really quite wobbly. And after the second week, I would gain a little bit of footing and go on from there. So April is Poetry Month. And Poetry Month is a time when poets attempt to write 30 poems in 30 days. Now, if you write 30 poems in 30 days and you try to write great poetry that will endure forever, you probably won't get 30 poems in 30 days. But if you just lean into the idea of writing something that's poetic every day for 30 days, you'll end up with 30 pieces. And I can guarantee you that in those 30 pieces, you will find material that will be quite valuable for you. Material you can use, a few lines that you can craft into other lines, maybe some information that you didn't expect that bubbled up from those I don't know rooms down deep in your psychology. Suddenly there's a memory that you haven't considered for years. It will pop up when you do the consistent work, like 30 poems in 30 days. And it really doesn't have to be April. It can be March. It can be any time you do this. Point is, it's all about the practice, the process, and allowing something to happen inside of you that comes up and it gets out on paper, or you can record it like I'm recording this now, or however you would like to deliver it. So when I got my diagnosis for prostate cancer, I was maybe 3 months out from the surgery on March 31st. I went to my doctor's office, Dr. Elizabeth Torden. She greeted me with a bit of a grim look on her face because she had the news that I might have prostate cancer. I was 61 years old at the time, and I will tell you, I had been going to see Dr. Torden since I was 37 years old. She had been my doctor for quite a while. Fortunately for her, she retired last year, so she's no longer my doctor. Unfortunately for me, I'm glad she's now pulled back and can spend time with her family. Back in 2011, she was not retired, hardly. She was fully in her practice, and I've been going to her for quite a while, and I was very proud of myself, a bit of hubris. I thought, I'm healthy as I can be. I had planned to take a trip to Paris and do a big show in Paris with my friend Walter Parks, and I was planning on doing that in April. This was January when I entered her office. It was a bit of a warm day. I stepped in thinking everything was fine. She walked in with that grim look on her face and said to me, We need to talk. I got your blood work back, and, well, I think we need to refer you to a urologist. You have a high PSA, and it's moved around a bit, and I'm afraid you might have prostate cancer. I can't tell you for sure if you do. You need to go see a urologist. There's a chance you might have it, and it's really worth checking out. Now, as I think back on the memory of that news, I remember it settling over me like a lead cape over my head. It was depressing. I went from being lighthearted and light-footed and full of verve to, oh my God, I'm going to die tomorrow. All I knew was I might have prostate cancer. I had no idea if it had spread. All I knew was that she was certain that my PSA had risen a point and a half, which didn't seem like much to me because I didn't know anything about a PSA moving. But a point and a half was quite a bit, especially in a short time frame. And what I mean by a short time frame, I had waited 16 months to have my yearly physical. Usually I was very prompt. I would get my physical every 12 months. For reasons I don't recall now, I waited 4 extra months to have my yearly physical. I immediately thought, oh God, I've waited too long. I've waited 4 months extra. I'll bet the cancer has jumped the margins and now it's in my system and I might not live for another year. I panicked. And if you've had an experience like this, you know what I'm talking about. I went to the negative right away. And I was, as I said, in shock. I was really surprised. So after the appointment was over, Dr. Torden said, I will refer you to Asheville Urologist. You can give a call there, be seen by a urologist, and get started with the process of determining whether you have prostate cancer or not. So I left the office, and I got in my car feeling half-self, if you can imagine such a thing, and I drove to a coffee shop. And I went into the coffee shop. Nothing had changed. Everything was just like it always was. People were ordering, smiling, saying good morning, chatting with their friends. I got my coffee. I sat in the corner and I looked around the coffee shop. Again, half there, thinking, well, this may not last much longer. Oh my God, I never imagined I would be the one that had cancer. Hubris, hubris, and more hubris. Of course things happen to us. They tie us up in knots. This is why they call it life, for God's sakes. Now, at the time, I knew that intellectually. And as I sat there in the coffee shop, looking out onto the scene, sipping my coffee, I just really didn't know what to do. So it took me a couple of days to actually adjust to the news. I decided right away that I would never tell anybody I had cancer because I would be showing my weaknesses. I didn't want to be weak. I didn't want to be smitten by cancer. And yet there I was having to deal with it. One thing I didn't know then, and I do know now, when things befall you, it's wise to let people know you've got some trouble and ask for a bit of help. I learned that a few days later. But in those first couple of days, I was keeping it secret because I thought maybe if I keep it secret, it'll go away. Well, you know how that works. Didn't go away at all. And I certainly couldn't put it off. I knew that. So I had to take some action. I wasn't quite sure what actions I wanted to take. I was scared. I just didn't know what to do. So as I sat there, I realized I knew Tara Meadows. Tara Meadows was married to Dr. David DeHole, who was a urologist practicing in Hendersonville, North Carolina, under the umbrella of Party Hospital. So about an hour or two later, I got over trying to keep the secret a secret and gave Tara Meadows a call. And she said, oh, okay, David can help you. Why don't you come over to our house tonight and talk to David about it? He can give you an overview of what to do. I can tell you now, I was grateful for that invitation. I felt a bit relieved, even though I still had the problem, big problem. I didn't feel like I would have to go it alone with strangers. So that evening I went over to their house. David gave me some really solid advice on what to do and how to approach the problem. Basically, he said, I will check with my partner, Dr. Scott Donaldson, and see if Scott will be willing to take you on as a patient. Since I know you, I can't take you as a patient, but you can come into our practice. So the next day, I gave David's office a call and made an appointment to see Dr. Donaldson. Fortunately, they had an opening the next week, so I made the appointment. And the next week, I showed up at the office and greeted Dr. Donaldson. The thing that was interesting about that moment when I met him, he came in the office, very cheery fellow, had a bow tie on, quite a classic character, really. And I was reading a poetry book by Roger Bonera Garr. And Dr. Donaldson saw the book and he said, well, what are you reading? I said, oh, this is a poetry book by a fellow that I know. Oh, I like poetry, Dr. Donaldson said. So for the first 15 minutes of the visit, we talked about literature. We talked about writing. He told me he loved poetry, he loved to write, he even loved to make a radio show every now and then. So we got off on a pretty good start with things that we both had in common. 15 minutes later, he said, oh, you have a problem, let's check it out. So he gave me straight up advice. He said, what we'll have to do, based on the report that I'm reading now, your PSA has moved around a lot. There's a good chance you might have cancer on your prostate. And if you do, we're going to have to find out. He suggested, and I agreed with him, that I needed to get a biopsy. Meanwhile, my life partner, Tish Valles, was working in New York, and by then I had told Tish about it, and she came down to spend the time with me, help me set this up and get it organized. So when I returned to the office a week later, Tish was with me. We did get the biopsy. Dr. Donaldson sent it off to pathology, and I walked out of the office hoping that I didn't have prostate cancer. Well, as you may have guessed, the information came back, and Dr. Donaldson called and said, yes, you do have prostate cancer. He also said, I can't confirm if it's jumped the margins or not. All I can tell you is that your prostate has cancer in most of the sections of it. Of course, I immediately said, do you think it's jumped the margins? He said, I have no idea if it has or not. The only way I can tell if it's jumped the margins is to do an operation, do a surgery, go in there, remove your prostate, and hope that we find that it hasn't jumped the margins. If it's within the margins, you probably won't need radiation, nor will you need chemotherapy. If it's jumped the margins, then we'll have to start with radiation and see where it goes from there. He was rather blunt about it, had a good bedside manner, but he was straightforward, didn't mince words, and I appreciated that a great deal. Keep in mind, this was 2011, it's been 15 years. A lot of progress has been made in how physicians go about treating prostate cancer and other cancer as well. So at the time, Dr. Donaldson said, you have a few choices. One, you can just not do anything at all. Keep your fingers crossed and hope that it's a slow-moving cancer and you might live 10 more years. He said, two, you can have the prostate frozen, which will arrest the cancer, but we won't be able to take it out. And if you freeze it, then there will be scar tissue. And because of the scar tissue, if it comes back, we won't be able to operate and take it out. Three, you can have it radiated, and that also will create scar tissue, and you'll have the same problem. If it returns, we won't be able to remove the prostate. And number four, Dr. Donaldson said, I can put you on the operating table. I can open you up. I can go in there. I can visually look at everything that I can see. I can spot where the cancer is on the prostate. I can also cut around the margins if I think it's spread a bit. I've done thousands of these operations. I know exactly what to look for, and I know exactly how to do this. He did tell me that it was a bit more invasive. He did say that I was running some risks. He also pointed out that whatever I did, I would be running risks. If you've ever had an operation, if you've ever gone to the hospital, if you've ever had to deal with any kind of medical situation, you know that there are always chances that it will not work. So he pointed all these out to me in our conversation, giving me the options to make these choices however I pleased. He was very cool about letting me make the choice. He said, whatever you choose, I'll be glad to do. here are my recommendations. He recommended the surgery going in because he knew what he was doing. He also pointed out, and this is something that you may not know out there listening, when you have your prostate removed, it alters your sexuality. To put it politely, you no longer have the same verve you had when you were 23, if you know what I mean. Dr. Donaldson explained this as well. My position was, I don't want to have prostate cancer. I don't want the cancer to jump the margins. I don't want to be looking over my shoulder every year thinking, when will it come back? I want to remove it, and whatever happens after that, however my sexual functions are altered, whatever comes, I want to at least be able to think and know that I gave myself as many options as I possibly could to continue living, because my goal was to live, make poetry, make art, do podcasts like this one that I'm doing now, and stay as relevant as possible in the world for as long as I possibly could. So I talked it over with Tish, and she was in the same camp I was. She said, I want you to be around for a while. I did too, so we agreed on that. With that in mind, I agreed with Dr. Donaldson, and I told him to go ahead and schedule the surgery as soon as possible, and I wanted him to go in and do what he had to do, take a look-see, cut what he had to cut, sew me back up, and send me back out into the world. I know I'm being a little flippant here with the way I'm describing it. I was very concerned. Even so, Dr. Donaldson was very practical about it. He said, my goal is to make sure that you can live a long, active life after you leave this operating table. So I was all for it. I was with him all the way. So we scheduled the operation for March 31st, which is today, 15 years later. I was relieved to move this along. I was also still quite worried about the cancer jumping the margins. I had no way of knowing if it had metastasized into other kinds of cancer. All I knew was that Dr. Donaldson would address it, and I would have some information in the next couple of days. March 31st, the day of the surgery, Tish was there. We went to Pardee Hospital in Hendersonville, North Carolina. We checked in. I remember clearly, spring day, beautiful. Tish and I went outside and walked around on the sidewalk in front of the hospital, reflected on what might come next, thought about the past and what had all happened up to that point. And after a bit of a ritual, we went in, checked into the room, and about 2 hours later, I found myself in the prep room getting ready to go into surgery. Dr. Donaldson came in and greeted me and told me he was ready to go, and he assured me everything would be okay and told me that after I woke up from the surgery, he would stop by and pay me a visit. If you've ever been in surgery, you know that once you start the countdown, 10, 9, 8, 7 to go under anesthesia, you never get to 1. You're completely asleep by 6 or 5. Which is what happened to me. I had no sense of time until I woke up the next morning, April 1st, in my hospital bed. I was groggy, disoriented. April is full spring in Western North Carolina. The sun shone through the window. Tish was sitting beside me in a green chair, scribbling in her notebook. I said, What are you up to? She said, oh, today is April 1st. Today is the beginning of poetry month. This is when the poets write 30 poems in 30 days, so this is my first poem. I was feeling a bit left out. Also, I didn't have anything else to do. I was in the hospital bed, and I knew I had at least 3 weeks of recovery with very little to do except sit around and wait for the recovery to happen. I just happened to also have a D50 Sony field recorder. I always have enjoyed recording sounds, and I usually have a recorder with me. Even to this day, I have recording equipment, and I like to collect sounds, sounds of trucks going downhill, sounds of doors slamming, sounds of musicians playing on the street, sounds of birds singing in the field in the springtime, that sort of thing. So I had my field recorder handy. I turned the field recorder on and said to Tish, I'm going to dictate a poem. and then I'll transcribe it and I'll post it on Facebook. So I turned the recorder on and dictated my first poem. So here it is. I titled it, After Surgery. I was still whole, so little had gone from my body. Groggy, after going in and out of morphine sleep, I looked around my hospital room. Clock on the wall, 8:30 a.m. Blue curtains covered the door. Last night I was warm and felt no pain. Tish slept beside me in a chair. I gave over to being loved, a miracle we all deserve. What a strange, strange relief it was to live and breathe, to feel my mouth so dry, all I wanted was ice. And that was the first poem I dictated into my D50 field recorder. I transcribed it, and I posted it on Facebook before midnight. I decided I would do it again the next day. Something about having a goal, something about keeping it small, a report from the field. I didn't really call what I had dictated a poem. It was more a report from the day, from that moment, what was going on around me. So after I processed it and posted it, the next day rolled around, and I thought, well, why not continue on with the second poem? I can certainly go forward for 30 days. After all, I don't have anything else to do except heal, and maybe writing poetry or doing these little field reports will connect me to something greater than myself and beyond the process of my healing, which indeed proved to be true. Later that day, David DeHole and Tara Meadows stopped by and brought me some muffins. Dr. Donaldson dropped in, said hello as he had promised, and told me the surgery went well. He said he felt very confident that he had gotten everything, but he couldn't guarantee it until the pathology came back to confirm what he suspected was going to be very good news, but no promises. So I felt a little bit better, more hopeful. Still, though, I didn't know if the cancer had jumped the margins or not. Before I go on with this healing story, I'd like to take a moment to say how important it is to pay attention to your health. I know you've heard that before, health is wealth, all the cliches, and really they're all true. And what I mean by paying attention to your health, there are simple recommended protocols that can really have great value over the long haul. The main idea is to get a physical every year. I know many of you out there listening maybe think that's not worth it, and perhaps that's true for you. All I can say is it was really worth it for me. As I said, Dr. Torden started seeing me when I was 37, and by the time I was 61, she knew everything about my medical history, and because of my regular checkups, I was able to catch the cancer before it consumed me. Cancer is everywhere. I don't believe I know one person in my life who hasn't been touched by cancer in one way or another. If they haven't had cancer, they know somebody who has. So it's definitely part of our lives, and the best way to keep cancer from overwhelming you is to get a checkup. And if you're a male, you may not be giving your prostate very much thought. Here's a sobering statistic. Almost every man alive, if he lives long enough, will end up with prostate cancer. You may have to wait until you're 95 to end up with it. You will end up with it at some point. If you're 95 and you realize you have prostate cancer, you probably don't have much to worry about because prostate cancer is slow moving. And if you're 95, likely you won't live another 10 years. So likely you will die of old age before you die of prostate cancer. If you're 55 or 61, like I was, it's really worth keeping up with it because when you catch it early, you have lots of options to deal with it. And some of you out there deal with it alternatively, which is a perfectly fine route to go. I have to say, I am not in that camp. I was in the Western medicine camp. I realized if I don't take action with surgery, I might not make it for another 10 years. You can do the math. I'm 76. I had the operation when I was 61. So you already know that the outcome was very positive for me. That said, I've talked to other people who have gone the alternative route, and they report much success. So I'm just reporting my strategy. Whatever your strategy is, if you are paying attention to your health, no matter what problems you have, you will feel better about it because you are responsible for yourself. And if you choose to be responsible for yourself and then reach out to other people when you have problems, you will discover what I discovered. As I said earlier, I thought I would keep it a secret. I decided not to keep it a secret. I managed to tell a few people in the beginning, and then I just told everybody. Well, sure enough, when I told people I was having a problem, folks stepped up to help me. Tish was there on day one, sitting in that hospital chair. I had to spend one more night in the hospital, and so on day two, I was released. Here comes the helpful part. My good friend A.D. Anderson, who lives still in Swannanoa, North Carolina, invited Tish and me to come to his house and spend 2 weeks while I was beginning my recovery. So Tish drove from the hospital to A.D.'s house in Swannanoa. It took about 45 minutes to get there. We drove up the long driveway. A.D.'s house was sitting on a knoll facing west. The lawn sloped down to the road. He greeted us, showed me my bedroom, and showed Tish her bedroom. We weren't able to share a bed because I was too restless. I was too tossy-turny. I had to have the place all to myself. And so that afternoon, I wrote my second poem, and it's titled How Thunder Runs. Restless on clean sheets, I woke from the second night of my hospital stay, thinking how thunder runs through everyone's life, not lightning, thunder, the boom, an expression of emergence. Last night, I dreamed a friend pulled me from the sea. Thunder rumbled. I woke, looked out the window, and realized that thunder has a pearl-like quality. Every boom is singular, like explosions you hear in a war zone. But that's not thunder. That's the sound of a whale with a broken back. My back is not broken. There are no wars here. So there are a lot of things that will make your back stronger. I was learning very quickly that my back was getting stronger because I was relying on the people around me, and I trusted their friendship. Now, lest I give you the impression that on the second day after my surgery, I was some literary figure writing poetry like crazy so I could stay relevant, I did write that second poem. As you noted, it's very short. But what I was really doing, I was streaming Dexter on Netflix. Actually, I wasn't watching it. I was binging the series. If you don't know that series, Dexter is a serial killer who works as a medical examiner in the police department. And occasionally people suspect him of being a serial killer, but nobody ever really catches him. And Dexter has a code. His code is the victims have to be people who are guilty of some horrible crime and they've been skipped over by justice. So he administers justice. It's completely, utterly wrong, and yet it's done so well that you pull for Dexter. You cheer him on. It's terrible. And I was there with my 13 staples in my belly watching Dexter. It was actually kind of funny. We also did a lot of other things as well being there. It was great fun. My friends Chiwa and Andrew stopped by with some food. Barbara Galloway and Bob Galloway stopped in. Other friends stopped by as well. Here again, I asked for help. I received a lot of help. Grateful for that. So today, all these years later, I often will end up in a conversation with someone and they will say, oh, you're a cancer survivor. And I'm very careful about how I frame my recovery. I did indeed catch the cancer. And indeed, Dr. Donaldson reported on day 7 that they had gotten all the cancer and I was clean. So I didn't survive cancer. What I did was have my prostate removed. My prostate was covered in cancer. Dr. Donaldson got all of the cancer. I didn't need radiation, nor did I need chemotherapy. So I was very lucky. I didn't survive cancer. I did have to pay attention to my healing. So when people say I was a cancer survivor, I acknowledge that. I did survive cancer. It wasn't much of an effort because I had paid attention. I did have to work getting my healing in order. So here we are back to me writing a poem each day. At first, I didn't know if I could do it or not. Then I started to look forward to it. It became an educational process for me. The observation was what was most interesting. Sitting there on the lawn or on the couch, just thinking of something, letting something bubble up from one of my don't-know rooms, and then jotting it down, trusting that whatever came out would work in that moment. So on the seventh day, as I said, Dr. Donaldson called and told me the cancer was clear. I was fine. After Dr. Donaldson's call, Tish and I celebrated. Then I settled down as evening entered the room and wrote the following poem. This was day seven. The poem's titled, I Had to Look. Just before dawn in a half-awake dream, I climbed down my spine one bone at a time into unfamiliar territory. I saw veins, arteries, cells, blood, connective tissue, nerves, lungs, liver, kidneys, urethra, and bladder. As I descended, I realized I was in a rainforest filled with creatures I didn't expect to see. Iguanas, bats, lizards, snakes, scaly-tailed squirrels, toucans, fairy bluebirds, and butterflies. Beautiful, graceful, complicated butterflies. I never imagined millions of butterflies were free inside my body. A purple butterfly landed on a bush, then another with pink-red dots, then another big brown eyes. I arrived at my pelvis. I stood between my hips. I thought, blades and fingers have invaded me. As I surveyed the cavernous territory inside my butterfly-filled body, I saw repair. Nothing to weep about here, I thought. With that, I climbed my spine, one bone at a time. This afternoon, Dr. Donaldson called. He said, your margins are clear. The cancer has not spread. That poem, I Had to Look, was written on April the 7th. As you can see, I'm addressing the healing, and I'm doing it by framing what's going on in the moments with me during those particular days. I ended up staying at AD's house for 2 weeks, and each day I wrote a poem. And then my friends Andrew and Chiwa invited me over to their house after the 2 weeks stint at AD's, and I stayed with Andrew and Chiwa for about, I guess, 3 or 4 weeks. And in that time, I sat mostly in Andrew's garden. He had beautiful gardens around his house. Unlike AD's house, which sat on a knoll, Andrew and Chiwa's house sat in a bit of an almost forest-like area. Still, though, lots of pear trees, fruit trees, lots of garden space. Andrew kept bees, so during the day I would sit under the trees and watch the bees come and go. I was staying upstairs in my room, and often I would wake up in the middle of the night, wide awake, and I would write my daily poem in the middle of the night. This one was on day 25, and it's titled, Your Mouth is Beautiful. My tiny clock purrs, 3 a.m. A mile away, long-haul trucks rumble along I-240. I have become a small pond. My face is a mirror. Gaze as long as you like. Consider the angle of your nose, the lift of your cheekbones, the slant of your eyes. Your mouth is beautiful. Yesterday in the roaring warm air, a guard bee from Andrew's hive stung my face. I'd ventured too near, thinking the bees would ignore me. Surprised and angry, I jerked the stinger from my cheek. Next time, I'll walk further around the hives. It's 4 a.m. My tiny clock still purrs. Your mouth is still beautiful. I wrote, Your Mouth is Beautiful, on day 25. That was about the time I started to think, what if instead of writing 30 poems in 30 days, what if I just kept going? What if I wrote 100 poems in 100 days? What would happen if I didn't miss a day and completed, instead of 30-30, 100-100 poems?
I got a kick out of the idea, and I thought, well, if you miss one, you don't have anything. But if you go for 100, everybody likes 100. Who doesn't like a $100 bill? If you live to be 100, you've done pretty well. 100 just seemed like a good number to shoot for. So on day 25, I thought, you know, I'm going to take a run at this. So I arrived at Andrew and Chiwa's house on the 17th of April, and they allowed me to stay until the 31st of April. And on the last day I was there, before I moved to Lake Eden Retreat, where I am actually recording this right now, I shared some cigars with Andrew, a parting ceremony. And so here's the poem that I wrote about the cigars. Title, yeah, you guessed it, Smoking Cigars. Late yesterday afternoon, Andrew and I smoked cigars while sitting on his porch, talking about how the black bear had destroyed his bird feeders. I mentioned I wanted to own an organic juice bar at a marina on the inland waterway. Andrew said he fancied making brooms, scented candles, and leather belts. We sang Willie Nelson's On the Road Again, while the tree peepers and other evening creatures harmonized in the symphonic canopy of Carolina leaves. So by the time I arrived at the 31st of April, I was back on my feet. I was moving around, ready to do something. So what I did was agree to drive people from the airport to Camp Rockmont in Swannanoa, which is next to Lake Eden Retreat. And the people I picked up at the airport were artists. They were coming for some kind of week-long gathering, a conference. So all I had to do was drive them from the airport and bring them to Camp Rockmont, and then at the end of the week, drive them back. I was capable of that. By that point, I had my legs back under me a bit. And then in return, I was given a little bit of money as well as an opportunity to attend the workshop. So I spent the week at Camp Rockmont working with the artist. And on the 36th day after my surgery, still at Camp Rockmont with the artist, I wrote this poem. It's titled, Bend Like Bamboo. Tish tells me to bend like bamboo when the wind blows in. Once, some friends and I cut bamboo along a stream and laced it into a dome. We threw canvas over the lopsided contraption and declared it a sweat lodge. We built a fire, gathered stones from the riverbank, and buried them under the hot coals until the stones glowed red. We shoveled each stone into the lodge, then entered through the flap and settled around the pile of stones that spat and sizzled when we splashed water over them. We fancied ourselves wisdom shamans, but we were only five ordinary people in a makeshift lodge, smearing our bodies with dirt while we swayed in the steam like bamboo bending in the wind. Stories come from many different places. That memory was a time when Andrew Brown and I were living on Beetree Road in Swannanoa, and we did indeed have a sweat lodge. And we would invite people over to go into the sweat lodge with us. It was beside a stream, and we got rocks from the stream, heated them up, and did exactly what I described in the poem. I suspect we bent like bamboo in the wind, but I don't know for sure. But we did get into the sweat lodge. So as you're starting to see, as I progress through my healing, my ordinary life is coming back into focus. After the gathering of artists at Camp Rockmont, I stayed around for a few days more to attend the Lake Eden Arts Festival. Many people refer to it as the Leaf Festival. On day 45, while I'm attending the Lake Eden Arts Festival, where I hosted the Poetry Slam on Saturday night, I wrote this piece, Sparkling Balls. This weekend, at the Lake Eden Arts Festival, I watched a fancy bearded juggler spin five sparkling balls between his legs and over his head, keeping time to Ricky Skaggs' bluegrass band, Kentucky Thunder. The juggler grinned and said, I'm Thomas. Not only can I juggle, I can talk to trees. Thomas whirled and danced into the crowd, with his bright balls swirling round and round in the afternoon air. I whispered, I'll bet Thomas knows what it'll cost him if he ever lets his hands stand still. So as you can see, I've arrived at day 45, which is almost halfway to my goal of 100 poems in 100 days. So after the Lake Eden Arts Festival was over on Tuesday, I caught a flight to Albuquerque and made my way to Taos, where I spent 3 weeks As you can see, by the time I got to the 45th day, I was back on my feet. I was doing many of the things I'd previously done, and I was enjoying it. I hosted the slam at the Lake Eden Arts Festival. That was a paid gig. I was back to doing the work that I enjoyed doing. The practice of writing one poem a day and getting it up on Facebook before midnight came around was paying off. I felt better about myself. I felt connected to the work I was doing. I had generated 45 poems by the time I finished the Leaf Festival, actually probably 46 because the 45th one was on Saturday, 46th one was on Sunday, and it went on and on like that. So by the time I made it to Taos, I was showing no signs of wear and tear, but I was showing signs of pleasure in writing these poems. I wrote poem number 54, day 54. The poem is titled My Little Crimes, and it takes place in two locations, one in Taos, the former Wired Cafe, which is no longer there, and the second location, years and years ago when I was a boy, in Asheville on Pine Lane in the 1950s. My Little Crimes. An hour ago, storm winds toppled a bright green urn into Dave's koi pond. The dangling tin can man rattled above the stairs where yesterday Rhonda told me that my prostate surgery had made me more vulnerable to chemtrails spewing from commercial jets. When the storm passed, sparrows scratched beneath the outdoor tables. A woman relaxed with a small piece of cake. I thought of the slices of German chocolate cake my grandmother occasionally served me when I was a boy. On days when she was washing clothes in her basement, I'd sneak into the blue pantry beside the white refrigerator and steal a slice. I've often wondered if she ever noticed my little crimes. And to this day, I don't know if she ever did notice my little crimes, but I still love German chocolate cake and will eat it if somebody ever serves it to me. It was really a delight. So as I moved through my Taos time, I spent much time at Wired Cafe generating these poems. And I also spent time socializing and visiting. I have to give Yale Jones credit because Yale was the one who made it possible for me to be in Taos during that 3-week period because he loaned me his Mini Cooper. And I rode around in that little Mini Cooper and I just had a great time. It's a little sports car if you don't know what a Mini Cooper is. And it was a 5-speed sports car, so it zipped around quite a bit. And Yale was so generous in loaning that car to me. So this next piece features Yale's Mini Cooper. It's titled, She Let Him Slip Away. Just south of Taos, yesterday morning on my way to Santa Fe, a road sign warned, bighorn sheep. I scanned the land for wildlife. Nothing moved, but my borrowed Mini Cooper, gliding 60 miles an hour, sunroof pushback, window down, scent of sage in the air, and Janis Joplin on the radio. I downshifted for the curves, and I started thinking about the first time I heard Janis cover Kris Kristofferson's Me and Bobby McGee. You know, I always thought when Janis said she let Bobby slip away, she meant he left her for another woman. Or he hoboed to Seattle because he loved the rails more than he loved her. Or he just plain turned mean and robbed a bank. Now I know better. Bobby died, and he did it in the arms of a woman who loved him. An hour after I got to Santa Fe, I watched a young married couple ordering sandwiches at the Aztec Cafe. They touched each other while they waited. The air was clean and dry. A few white clouds floated in the egg blue sky. I wrote She Let Him Slip Away on day 55, getting deeper and deeper into my goal to 100 poems. And then on day 61, still in Taos, thinking about my next beat, which would be New York City a few days later, I wrote this, Who Am I Now? Every day the memory of my surgery recedes like the Taos sunsets. The recent irritation at the bottom of my scar has receded, along with the fear I might never be myself again. Of course, I'll never be 32, kicked back on a festival blanket, watching dancers whoop and swirl up and down, round and round. Who I was then is not who I am now, nor who I will be tomorrow or later this summer when I stroll around Prospect Park, across New York City's 14th Street to catch a train, watch pigeons, and talk to my friends over coffee in an all-night diner on First Avenue. So I wrote that piece in Taos anticipating my trip to New York City. I have been going in and out of New York City since the 70s. I don't claim to be a New Yorker. Never will be. I'm from Asheville. I'm a Carolina fellow. That said, I'm very familiar with New York. I've enjoyed that city quite a bit. And during that time frame, Tish was working in the advertising marketing business in New York. So I was there quite a bit. In fact, I could say we lived together in New York City, although I did move around a fair amount. So in all fairness, Tish held down the fort in New York City, and I came in and out. That said, we were familiar with the place. It was a very exciting scene in New York during that time. We were closely associated with the performance poets in New York. So after I finished my time in Taos, I caught a plane, JetBlue, midnight flight, overnight, arrive 5 a.m., JFK, catch the train to town, and there it is, New York City. We were staying with M.J. Watkins, and M.J. was gracious enough to allow us to spend the time with her. So it was great fun, and I enjoyed New York quite a bit. So as we move toward the end of our time together, I'm leaning more into the stories that I wrote from the poetic point of view around my healing process. New York is New York. The subway is still there, and the sounds are the sounds of New York City. This is poem number 87. 87th day. I'm getting closer to my goal. This is titled Brunch in Brooklyn. A cool breeze on Vanderbilt Avenue blew across a laughing couple getting out of their vintage BMW, hungry for an early dinner at Cornelius Cafe, full of light and shadows and the regular Saturday gathering of poets. In the middle of a conversation about why Ulysses was restless in his kingdom, I thought about how Lara's theme in Dr. Zhivago had heightened my sense of romance when I was 15. We were all poetic friends, laughing away the afternoon, full of honey, wine, and smoky stories of Cuban music weeping from old radios, falling out of a postcard sky after the neighborhood parties ended and nobody wanted to go home. That was poem 87. I had almost reached my goal on that day, and I knew I would reach my goal. No reason now to stop. 100 poems in 100 days was in sight. And I was back to my old self. I had healed, mostly. A few little odds and ends here and there, but mostly I was moving along, managing to do all of the things I had done prior to my surgery. And I had a collection of poems on top of it. I ended up calling it a manageable memoir, really. Poetry, yes. Prose, yes. Reflections on what happened moment by moment, yes. A manageable memoir, 100 Days, Poems After Cancer, which was published 5 years ago by 3 Ataos Press out of Denver, Colorado. So as we finish the last bit of time together that we have on this show, I'll close with a couple of poems toward the very end. This is poem number 97, titled The Wedding. At 6 a.m., I hopped out of bed and dressed for our trip to Boston for my nephew Sammy's marriage to Emily. She, the love of his life, he, the love of hers. The familiar I-95 road sounds reminded me of other journeys on I-40 across the Mississippi, I-70, Kansas wheat, and the live oaks going into Charleston on I-26 in Low Country, South Carolina. Clouds floated above the trees 97 days after my surgery. Tish drove MJ's borrowed BMW into Boston, 900 miles from my family home in Asheville. My brother Sam escorted the wedding guests along the park lawn. Sammy and Emily exchanged vows in the cycle of permanence. A ceremony requires a ritual opening of the heart. I sat on the front row in a time and place of 4 generations. The day has the night to thank for its passing. Now we're getting very close to the Magic 100. Here's poem 99.
Summer entices me. I am delighted with my body's return. A couple of hours ago, I nibbled fries from the Shake Shack while admiring a magnificent sculpture named Echo, a bone-white, 44-foot head of a 9-year-old girl in a dream state staring south across Madison Square Park toward Broadway. Echo's stone-braided hair flowed to the lawn. Teenagers tossed frisbees in and out of her shadow. After I finished my fries, my memory moved to a hand-lettered wooden sign that said, "Pray," which I once saw nailed to the outside wall of Michelle's Pawn and Gun Shop in a small North Carolina town, not far from a large Cherokee burial mound where tourists visit when the weather warms. I circled once around Echo, lingered a few minutes more, then started walking south down Broadway, delighted with my body's return. And now we arrive at poem 100. It's titled Slightly Altered. Just west of Spring Street, I paused under a maple for a phone conversation with my friend Julia Cameron in Santa Fe. Julia told me a grassland whiptail lizard had just scurried over her rug, paused beneath the trash can, then darted out her kitchen door into the desert, perhaps to dig for termites or find shelter under a log in the noonday sun. I have found refuge in the past 100 days in the Appalachian Mountains around Asheville, in the High Taos Desert, in New York City. I trust now more than ever in what moonlight can do. I am not the same man I was before my surgery, nor will I ever be. So that was my 100th poem, Slightly Altered. I wish I could read all of those poems to you. I've read them aloud before, and I enjoy each one in its own way. So what happened after I finished writing all of these poems, I compiled them in a manuscript and self-published it on Amazon under the title Looking at Light. And it stayed on Amazon for a while. A lot of people ordered it, got a few good reviews. I didn't really try to push it all that much. I was just really satisfied with having recorded the experience. And I shared the poems in performance and other places like that. And then 2018 rolled around, and Andrea Watson from Three at Taos Press asked me if I had a manuscript. And I told her I did have a manuscript of the 100 poems that I'd written in 100 days and had published it once already. She said, "I would love to see that." So I brought her the manuscript. She took a look at it, and she said, I would like to publish this. Can I publish it?" I said, "No problem. Happy to allow that to happen." So I came back into the studio, and I went through each poem. Now, what I didn't tell you when I was reading the poems, every poem in 100 days has a prompt that goes along with the poem. So it's 100 poems or 100 prose pieces, depending on how you define poetry, along with 100 prompts. So it works well for people who are trying to keep their relevance in the troubled times. And we do live in troubled times right now. You know that. I know that. Sometimes when our health fails, the trouble gets very, very close in. And we all eventually fail. We're not going to be here forever. But we are here right now in this moment. You're listening to me, and I'm speaking to you from Lake Eden. It is springtime. I am finishing this recording on April 1st. I started it on March 31st last night, came back, and this morning I'm working on it and finishing it up. So this is the launch of my 100-day experience after my surgery. I did get over it. I still have to tell you, though, I think about it a fair amount. And if you've ever had surgery or anything that was traumatic like that, you probably remember it too. It informs the way you think. I was talking to a group of writers last night on a Zoom call, and they were asking about what to do with all the trauma. Why do people spend so much time talking about the trauma, writing about the trauma? And I said, I felt like we all share trauma. That's just part of what we do as human beings. Trauma exists. If you write, if you work creatively, you can use the trauma in your life to inform the material that you present. As you
heard when I read these poems, I didn't talk about cancer the whole time. I'm talking about whipped-tailed lizards and motorcycles and things moving around and wired cafe and little jingly things hanging from the ceiling. But underneath all that, I was being informed by the experiences around my cancer surgery. So it all folds together in one way or another. And so you have to really trust that. And I did say to the people on the Zoom call in that conversation, I said, trauma is commonplace. Now, this is not to discount your trauma. Your trauma is not commonplace to you, nor is my trauma commonplace to me, or anybody else for that matter. But because we all share levels of experiences that include trauma, trauma itself is common to the human condition. It helps inform us. In many ways, I will say I'm a much better human being because of my cancer than prior to it. I ended up getting quite a bit of a relationship with hubris. And over the last 15 years, I have learned, while it's good to be grateful for what you have, what you do, and who you are, it's also really smart to not get too overdone and feel too important about things that affect you, because things are affecting all of us all the time. And on that note, I'm going to say thanks for listening to Twice 5 Miles Radio, fertile ground for conversations worth listening to and remembering. I'm your host, James Nave. Thanks, Walter Parks, for our theme song. WalterParks.com for more on Walter's music. Devine Dial, thank you for managing WPVM-FM in Asheville. Mike Tilley and Robin Collier, thank you for managing KCEI-FM, Cultural Energy Radio, in Taos. You can always reach me, Nave@JamesNave.com. I would love to hear from you. You can acquire the book, 100 Days, if you want to, by going to JamesNave.com. You'll see the link to where the book is at 3 at Taos Press, if that's of interest to you. I hope it is, actually. It makes a great gift. So there it is, my friends. Another show down. It's April. Happy April. Happy spring. If you're in the Southern Hemisphere, happy fall. And if you are along the equator, well, seasons don't really change. It's just the season that you're in. Wherever you are in the world, lean into what you're doing. Enjoy who you are. And I do hope you come back sometime soon. And until then, I'll catch you on that turnaround somewhere down the line.
The radio is an art form, you know. We don't want it to die. And I'm afraid that the people that buy all the radio stations might forget that this is not just a tool to make money. It's part of our society. It colors the way we act, the way we treat each other. You know, it's much bigger than a tool to make money. It's an art form. So, but what's great, what's ultimately the best about it, is it's fun and it's entertaining. And that's all we want to do, is raise that question of, hey, how come we're not having as much fun as we did?
Opens up the door and she lets you in. And never once does she say, where have you been? She says, hold it, are you hungry? Did you eat yet? Let me hang up your coat now. And all the time she's smiling, never raises her voice. It's 5 o'clock in the morning, and you don't give it. a second thought.